93 FM, Montreal.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world. Welcome.
I'm speaking with anarchist, author, and activist Tom Nomad. Tom Nomad is an organizer based in the Rust Belt and the author of The Master's Tools, Warfare, and Insurgent Possibility, as well as Toward an Army of Ghosts. You can find Tom's writings on the Anarchist Library as well. So we're going to speak a little bit about conspiracy theories and real conspiracies, strategies of tension, and like the use of extremist actors to set contradictions of concentrating power undemocratically. Thank you again for agreeing to have this conversation. I'm really stoked to have it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Weird world, huh? So as a bit of context, I was listening to it. This is kind of rambly, but I was listening to an episode of the Empire Never Ended podcast, and they mentioned this BBC documentary from 1992 that's in three parts. It's available on YouTube about Operation Gladio, which is a stay-behind armies in Europe meant to put in by NATO and the U.S., meant to disrupt any and undermine any communist anarchist organizing or Soviet invasion. This is a subject that I've had some awareness of for a while now, but I haven't really dug into, partially because so much of the cloak and dagger stuff can be really hard to pull back and to figure out what really happened. So it's sort of like looking into COINTELPRO in the U.S. besides where actual documentation is thorough, if redacted. There's a lot of like disinformation around the edges of it. So yeah. I reached out to you here because there are some important parts of strategy attention that I know that you've written about and thought about, and some theorists that you've been studying that deal with this. And I think you're a smart dude.
Oh, thank you. I'm flattered.
So I wonder if we could first talk about, I don't know if you want to go into or I could sort of like touch on a few points of like the history of, at least in the context of Operation Gladio and the stay behinds after World War II, like what that looked like and where the funding was and what sort of activities people engaged in.
Yeah, sure. So Project Gladio often gets associated with what happened in Italy, and that's definitely the, say, area of highest concentration for operations. But it was a, prior to NATO, Western Union, which was kind of the organization which led to NATO, sort of built this program up after World War II. And the idea was that they were going to take non-communist elements of partisan forces. So I think we often think of partisans during World War II as communists and anarchists, and most of them were. But in France, for example, the Christian Democratic Union had a militia, right? The same thing in Italy. And so they took these right-wing forces and kind of fused them together into these, they referred to them as paramilitary groups. They were essentially, as you referred to them, stay-behind forces, right? Now, stay-behind forces mean a number of different things. And in this case, they meant there's a wide variety of different things that happened. Most of the time, what it meant was that they were sort of, at one point, training and funding and organizing a clandestine group of people whose job it was to sort of prevent communist infiltration into Western Europe, and to be there in case of a Soviet invasion. Largely, they were trained in things like sabotage operations. They were trained in intelligence gathering. They were trained in the kind of things you would do if you were sort of a resistance fighter behind enemy lines, right? But a lot of those people were also really well connected in with whatever right-wing political parties existed after World War II. And many of those people rose to positions of power. Very similarly to the way that things sort of operated with the U.S. and Central and South America over the 20th century, where we would sponsor right-wing forces, and oftentimes those forces would sort of have their own agendas on top of whatever we were pushing them to do, and they would rise to power, and then we would have these allies in power, and this would lead to sort of puppet state governments. Similar things happened in Gladio, but not in as direct of a way. And there were, you know, definitely alliances that existed between later NATO and kind of the offices within NATO that dealt with clandestine warfare. And some of these parties, like Christian Democratic parties that existed all the way up through, you know, the late 1980s, early 1990s.
My understanding is that the Operation Gladio name gets put on often because that was the name of the project specific to Italy. And yes, that a bunch of these different projects in various countries had their own project names and had, to some degree, although, you know, it's kind of hard to document it, funding from the CIA at the time. Mm-hmm. And it kind of seems pretty normal. Like, you've got this formerly militarized forces all around, in a lot of cases, forces that, you know, maybe were clandestine far right groups in countries mm-hmm. that were either invaded by the Soviet Union or had a socialistic government or were invaded by the Allies or aligned with the Allies, that were ostensibly like firming themselves up and readying themselves for a communist infiltration or a communist invasion. That was their like greatest fear. And so for them to just be activated to do this sort of stuff, or they were fascists and they were inherently anti-communist, so they were just kind of doing more of the same. There's like stories about Operation Werewolf in Germany, and that's like a huge, that meme and that idea is still being pulled up by the far right. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you would talk about like what sort of activities that we know of that you're aware of that those groups ended up getting engaged in. They have affiliation with the policing structures to some degree. Yeah. They have like a nod. This is the point that you make in some of your writing and some of your speaking, is that like anarchists and the people in general often think of the state as a unitary structure, that the right hand knows what the left hand is doing in all cases. And I think that Gladio and stuff like this is kind of an example of where that's not the case, right?
Yeah. Gladio is actually, according to the CIA documents, kind of a disaster, right? And it's a disaster for similar reasons that every other attempt to foster kind of right-wing paramilitary forces by the CIA was a failure. William Colby, who ended up becoming the director of the CIA during the tail end of the Vietnam War, he was involved in a lot of the setting up of these very specifically clandestine paramilitary forces. And there's a common pattern here, whether we're talking Central South America or Southeast Asia or in Europe, there's this pattern. And the pattern's the following. The CIA has very specific goals. Right. And in the case of Gladio, NATO had very specific goals. And those goals are often relatively straightforward and they're relatively easy to identify. So, for example, in the case of Gladio or in the case of fostering right-wing forces in Vietnam or Korea or trying to do the same with the Contras in Central South America, the goal was to prevent sort of the expansion of a Soviet sphere of influence. Now, they talked about it as preventing the domino effect or preventing the spread of communism, but really it was grounded in preventing this kind of expansion of the Soviet sphere of influence and later the Chinese sphere of influence, which is kind of where a lot of that tension exists now. So in all of these cases, what happens is that the CIA kind of parachutes in, or in the case of Europe, was left over from the OSS, and they start organizing these groups together and they fund them and they give them a relatively straightforward mission. They say, okay, we need you to say, use your newspaper. So in the case of Italy, it'd be like, we need you to use your newspaper to promote this right-wing political party, and we're going to give you a bunch of money to continue to run your newspaper. Or we're going to give the Christian Democratic Party in Italy, for example, all this money. And the CIA was the source of something like, depending on the estimate, somewhere between 20 and 80% of all of the funding that they used in like the 60s and 70s. We're going to do this because the communists are getting, you know, popular. We need you to win the you know, parliamentary elections. In a place like France, a lot of that was about sort of maintaining the power structure around de Gaulle and people like that. Now, in all of these cases, though, these entities that were selected have their own goals, right? The Contras, for example, in Central and South America, they were running drugs. They were aspiring to power. They had connections to all these big corporations and plantations sort of in these countries. And so they had these goals, which were economic and political. In Europe, specifically in Italy, a lot of the people that were worked with were fascists, and they had this goal. They had this series of goals. Now, the fascists in Italy were aligned with the church, and they were aligned with the business class. And so they had this kind of series of goals that they could push partially through the Christian Democratic Party, but also they engaged in street actions, right? Now, the question always becomes, and this is where it gets really murky, what was done at the behest of the CIA and what was not? And really, we have a number of documents that we can rely on, and they're not all from the CIA. So some of them are, and there are plenty of records from the CIA that just sort of point to kind of the more banal, more innocuous parts of these kind of operations. There's documents from the CIA that point to less innocuous parts of these kinds of operations as well, but most of them are kind of centered around sort of legal political interventions and kind of the boosting of certain political forces. But we also have documents from Italy. We have documents from France. As sort of socialist governments took over in those places, periodically they would release documents about what happened with the stay-behind forces. And so what we really get is we get this picture of really a failed CIA operation, right? I mean, it was successful in the sense that right-wing forces were able to keep communist parties out of power. But it was unsuccessful in the sense that the CIA was not able to keep control of the forces that they themselves were promoting. And in a place like Italy, that turned into a lot of political violence, that a lot of what happened during the years of lead, right? What in the US we often talk about as the strategy of tension. Those years, those same forces were the forces that were carrying out attacks at behest of the state police. There's no record, though, that those were being called forward by the CIA, though. Right. And this is where these kinds of operations get really murky. And this is really where like research skills become really important. And this is where understanding how conspiracy theories work become really critical, because we need to be able to speak about these things realistically and not through sort of inference or hyperbole, as they often are.
I definitely want to get into ways of thinking about these kind of activities that avoid those sort of conspiratorial thinking. And I think mm-hmm. that there's we should make the point that there is a difference between a conspiracy and a conspiracy theory, because people right. conspire all the time. This is a word that, or this is like a phrase that Robert Anton Wilson used to say that I really appreciated, was just that anytime you've got a backroom full of bankers, or you've got a bunch of government ministers getting together, making a decision to make, you know, to do something. Anytime you've got a bake sale being planned, like people are conspiring to do a thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's nefarious. It's people agreeing to do a thing, which is why like gang charges or conspiracy charges that are used against political dissidents oftentimes are like, well, you agreed to be in a place at a time around other people, and yeah. they're like ipso facto, you are a part of this criminal conspiracy that we can charge you with. Mm-hmm. So just sort of like blowing up, because you've been bringing up Latin America and like Southeast Asian examples as well. Like the idea that the U.S. goes in and funds certain movements, certain groups. And again, to like touch back on what I said, that like governments aren't unitary. There's also other ways that intervention happens, and sometimes with the CIA's affiliation and sometimes with not. Like right now, anytime there's some sort of unrest in a country that has a political position that's somehow in opposition, or economic position in opposition to the U.S. government, there's a lot of people on the far right, as well as I would say tankies, oftentimes that get drawn into this idea that this is a CIA op, that yeah. this is a thing that is totally plays into like it's a what's the term in Latin, and like qui bono, like who does it benefit,
right?
This is the approach that people often take, is to look at the event and say, aha, what part of the international spectrum of power would want this to occur in this way or to undermine this group? And they oftentimes point to the CIA, which kind of takes away the agency of the people that are actually involved in it and the complexity yes. of the situation. But I've seen that pointed to, for instance, with the Otpor movement and the end of Milosevic in former Yugoslavia, this popular movement that got Western quote-unquote democratic like think tank money mm-hmm. to help them think through their process, and also to give them like gave them books on nonviolent theory, movement theory, and also to push them in a certain direction. You've got this through a bunch of the color revolutions that happened around Europe and in parts of Asia. And Peter Gelderlos writes about this a bit. You get this today also where, for instance, there are mass disagreements in the streets with regimes like Nicaragua under Ortega, or mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. Cuba, where people are unhappy with what the government's doing at the time. And there's a mass show of disagreement, and certain sectors of the media and, you know, the tanky left or whatever say, aha, you know, it's against these administrations can't be doing anything wrong. It's like, therefore it is a CIA op.
Yeah. So this kind of idea, I think, is structured around a number of things, which are important to kind of tease out. Firstly, there's very obviously like confirmation bias going on here. That's the simplistic sort of reading, I think, right? Like there's confirmation bias happening. We see this with tankies all the time. You see this with groups like the PSL, which are entirely comfortable excusing away not just people's motivation, but genocide, right? Like, to be really clear about this, like, the PSL excuses genocide, like excuses states coming in and say, rounding up Uyghurs in China and throwing them into re-education camps, or they support the North Koreans murdering political dissidents in mass, right? Like, just to be clear about this. Now, of course, they can't come forward and say, we're genocide sympathizers, right? So that's kind of an unpopular position. So they have to come forward and say, oh, none of the genocides are happening. All these videos are doctored by the CIA, blah, 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 blah. We see similar things with the right wing as well. We see things like this with, like, QAnon, for example, right? And the thing that's fascinating about conspiracy theories now, and this is a topic for a different conversation, but something that I think bears bringing up, is that conspiracy theories now no longer function on this level of there being a body of phenomena and then some sort of narrative that's constructed retroactively about those phenomena. What's happening now is that the narrative gets constructed as things are occurring, which is really, really different. And what it means is that conspiracy theories have become far more reactionary even than they were before. That now it is purely about choose position, construct conspiracy that can justify position in the face of counter evidence, right? We see this pretty consistently. Now, the second part of this that I think is really important is to recognize that really part of the reason that conspiracies can sort of exist in relation to, say, something like a political uprising in Cuba or even Venezuela, right? Which, you know, there were many right-wing forces involved in Venezuela, but it wasn't everybody. Is a lot of this falls down into sort of simplistic narratives that are meant to describe things which are by their own nature secretive, right? So things which we don't know about. So in a situation where we don't know something, there's a tendency to want to create an explanation. If we can't explain, for example, within our own thinking, so like say we were a member of the PSL and we were watching, for example, there were massive riots in Shenzhen, China this past week, okay, where people were like throwing bricks at cops. A lot of them were migrant workers. They were sort of protesting COVID restrictions and things like this, right? Now, of course, to the PSL, that's impossible, right? Just like the uprising in Hong Kong was impossible. It wasn't that there were people that were angry because it's socialist utopia. That couldn't possibly be. We see similar things in the United States. We saw this during the uprising when Democratic mayors and police chiefs in Democratic cities were saying it couldn't possibly be because of the failure of reformism. Really, this is about professional anarchists and out-of-town agitators, right? It's a very similar narrative. So what happens here is that we have this sort of zone of indiscernibility, right? Say CIA motives or classified information or something like this. And then we have this phenomena, which in reality is very complex. We look at, say, the uprising in Kazakhstan, or even say the uprisings in Italy in the 70s, right? Which even a lot of anarchists, I think, see in really unitary ways, but they're really complex things. And so instead of diving into the complexity, instead of sitting there and saying, well, the CIA might have this motivation, but people on the ground might have this motivation, and some people might have this motivation, but other people have this motivation. Instead of really diving into the nuances and complexities, instead what we do is we come to simple conclusions. So we say things like, okay, well, my tanky left-wing party, for whatever reason, supports the Assad regime, so therefore every single person fighting the Assad regime has to be working for the CIA.
Like the White Helmets.
Yeah, right, like the White Helmets, or I mean, I've even heard tankies say this about the YPG, which like fly red and black flags and stuff, you know, it's like pretty obvious where their politics are. So then there's this kind of third element here. And the third element really has to do a lot with the fact that actually in a lot of places, the CIA does have presence, right? There's this reality in which, say, we take Otpor, right? And Otpor is an interesting example because I've actually been to Serbia. I've actually talked to those people. This was more than 15 years ago at this point. And some of them, interestingly enough, were in government at the time. They were members of the Social Democratic Party. And the thing that they said is, yeah, the Democracy Institute came here and they trained us in things like nonviolent protest organizing and things like that. But we already had to have the motivation to get that going. And we were the ones that had to carry that through. And so even if funding was sometimes coming from overseas, which it wasn't always, and they said over time, that was less and less and less the case. The fact that millions of Serbs are willing to show up in the streets and overthrow the government is the important part. And not all of those people were, quote, CIA stooges, right? Most of these people were people who were living through a financial crisis that was spawned by a genocidal war being waged by their government. And they didn't like living in financial desperation. And they didn't necessarily agree with the war. We have to remember that in the former Yugoslavia, that was an incredibly cosmopolitan space prior to this kind of rise of nationalism, which played off dynamics that had been present. But many people in the former Yugoslavia weren't necessarily identifying with X, Y, or Z ethnic group in the early 90s. And so there are political conditions that allowed those things to happen. So we have these three difficulties, right? We have these kind of political biases. We have the sort of inherent lack of clarity of things which are secretive. And we have this sort of dynamic in which there is intervention on some level. But I think what's really important to kind of tease out here and to sort of understand is, where does that intervention stop as being a motivating factor? Where does it begin? So let's take just as an example of something which I think most of us would rightfully reject, and that is the narrative of the outside agitator, right? We know that that narrative was a very powerful narrative in the 1950s and 60s that was used against the civil rights movement. And right-wing politicians and pro-segregationist politicians would say, oh, well, those are outside agitators. It's communists coming in here and riling everybody up, which of course asserts that Black activists in the South during the civil rights movement were sort of passive agents that were sort of pushed forward by white communists sort of outside of their own intention, and that these white communists were able to manipulate these people that didn't really have the intelligence to understand what was happening. It's a completely racist and absurd narrative. And yet people on the quote left replicate that narrative all the time, literally all the time, to justify all kinds of things and to explain away all kinds of things. There's also the reality that these uprisings, when we see them, are spectacularly complex, and we often can't see the complexity. So we take something like Egypt, right? The Tahrir Square uprising. There were many political factions on the ground there. I know people that were on the ground there. I know anarchists that were on the ground there. And they're like, yeah, there were like capitalists, there were conservatives, the Muslim Brotherhood was there, like anarchists were out in the streets, there are lots of communists. Like, there was no unified political vision except getting rid of the regime. And that was a common objective. And that's all that was needed to push forward that uprising. We can hear the words of the people that participate in these things. We don't have to explain those words away. We can hear those words. And oftentimes what those words are that regardless of how this thing started, regardless of what motivated its beginning, the second that people hit the streets, and in Egypt, my friends that were over there say the veil of fear kind of fell away, that's when things change. And that has nothing to do with outside money. That has everything to do with people's motivation, right, and intent. So when we're looking at these things, we have to keep these complexities in mind and recognize, like, the Democracy Institute did train activists in Egypt prior to the uprising. Like, that's true. They did it at American University in Cairo. We know this. April 6th Youth Movement has talked about this openly. So often what happens in these situations is that people are looking for something really secret and hidden, when in reality, almost everything is out in the open if you're willing to look for it. If you're willing to dig around social media, if you're willing to embrace complexity, if you're willing to suspend your own preconceived conclusions, you can gather the information that you need. I mean, we live in this amazing age where I remember, I was writing my doctoral thesis. This was in 2010. The Egyptian uprising was happening, was just kind of getting moving. Things were going down in Syria and Libya, and we could follow what was happening minute by minute, like on Al Jazeera. And it was the first time we could do that. That changes everything now. We don't need to rely on partial reports anymore. We don't need to rely on what documents we get. We don't need to rely on biased sources. We can get information straight from the streets. When we can do that, we can start to see these complexities that exist in ways that I think were really difficult in, say, the 1970s, where a lot of these narratives about the CIA being the secret hand behind everything really built up in the American, kind of specifically authoritarian left. Those built up at a time when there wasn't necessarily that information. And very specifically, those built up at a time when, as we know now, Soviet disinformation campaigns were a thing. And they were laundering disinformation through the American left-wing media. And we know this. Actually, a wonderful example of that, if we want to get back to Gladio really quick, is what's referred to as the Westmoreland Field Manual. So the Westmoreland Field Manual is the basis that a lot of people use to connect Project Gladio to the strategy of tension. And the term strategy of tension appears in this document, right? So this document was supposedly a counterinsurgency manual that was signed by General Westmoreland, supposedly, and explained how you carry out false flag attacks and blame left-wing groups for it. That was published in a Turkish newspaper in 1975. That's the first time anybody saw it. After the fall of the Soviet Union, we have come to find out that that was a forgery, as were many things that were passed around at that period of time, including documents from the CIA talking about AIDS in Africa. That conspiracy theory started with Soviet disinformation too. And so when we're getting into this world in which we're starting to talk about intelligence agencies, information is key. And hyperbole can be the death of whatever understanding you're trying to build, because you're starting to move outside of the realm of demonstrability and losing the patience necessary to sort of dig into that from an information first perspective.
Yeah. And thank you. Thank you very much for that. And for pointing out the Westmoreland document too. There's a confirmation bias thing where, like, when you get information that the CIA was conducting bombings and then blaming it on left-wing groups or claiming to have been left-wing groups or infiltrating left-wing groups, then you see the document and you're like, aha, see, well, this yep. must be true because this is like the CIA, this is embarrassing to the CIA. So therefore, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the other examples of intervention and the complexity that it brings. But also I want to talk about, like, and maybe this is cart before the horse moment, but so yeah, as you said, like the information's there, you can dig into the information. One of the things that I feel is that there is so much information out there. Like it used to be, I guess, at a certain point, unless you are a researcher. And that doesn't mean professionally, but this is like what you put your passion and your time into, at least, that you would dig into stuff and then like interface with other people to sort of, let's say, like bake out the crumbs mm-hmm. into some sort of like picture that makes sense of the world. And that, I mean, that's the sort of the glut of information and the glut of disinformation that people are pulling from is, you know, that little reference to QAnon right there, like... This is what people are trying to do ostensibly, but they're missing the mark.
Yeah.
And maybe there's like a degree of like knowledge for a lot of people that are doing that because it feels like a game, because it feels fun, because they're like upping the ante with each other. But like, how do people who are not engaged in that game sort of like extricate themselves or recognize when they're starting to do that and starting to overcomplexify issues that maybe Occam's razor would like nix?
Yeah. So a lot of it comes down to understanding how conspiracy theories are structured, right? And they're all structured with a very similar kind of epistemic architecture, right? If you want to put it that way. And that is that conspiracy theories often start around something that is inexplicable or confusing or difficult to make sense of, right? Right now, we're seeing this proliferation of conspiracy theories happening right now, I think often because, well, the categories that we used to use to make sense of the world, say in the 90s or the early 2000s, don't really work anymore, right? Concepts like nation states, notions like capitalism, right? Things like this are all getting challenged in ways that make a lot of people really uncomfortable is kind of, I think, a very dramatic understatement. They make it really difficult for people to locate themselves in the world. And one of the responses to that is the rise of right-wing nationalism. And one of the responses to that is the rise of conspiracy theories. And that's part of the reason why they're deeply, deeply, deeply tied together. So the question becomes, okay, how do we then start to locate ourselves, right? One of the things that's happened in the world is that I think it's become really obvious that our understandings of the world in the past were tragically simplistic, not just on the level of sort of categorical understanding, but on the level of how we understand how things function, how we understand communities work, how we understand that even social dynamics function or institutions exist. All of these things have kind of changed, right? This is sort of a result of the post-structuralist turn that happened in the 1970s. So there's this sort of open field right now in which this kind of change of normativity, this kind of collapse of former norms, and this sort of process in which we're kind of reestablishing notions of sense tends to lead to what is not always a bad thing. Well, is often not a bad thing, but tends to lead to this notion of self-empowerment, right? People are now tasked with coming up with their own understanding of the world, and they do this. Now, the question all becomes how, and what is the epistemic structure of what that looks like? So we take something like, let's just jump back quick to QAnon. If you really pay attention to QAnon people, they don't consider themselves uninformed. In fact, they consider themselves profoundly well-informed, that they do what they call research, which research means that they go around on a bunch of blogs that they get linked to from Facebook, and they find a bunch of articles that confirm things that they already think, and then they cite them. And we look at that and we go, well, that's ridiculous and absurd and silly. But then you can read academic papers, and academics do a very similar thing a lot of the time, right? They find sources that agree with what they already want to conclude, and they cite. In conspiracy theories, this leads to something really interesting, which is what I refer to as the kind of logical leap of conspiracy theory, right? Which means that you start off in a realm of observability, okay? We can even take, say, the 2020 election conspiracy theory, just as an example. The observable fact here is Trump lost the election, right? That's the observable fact, that if you look at the numbers on the television, Donald Trump lost. Then a lot of those people are combining that with a second observable fact, and they've talked about this openly on the internet, which is, well, they didn't know anybody that didn't vote for Donald Trump, so how could he have lost, right? Which I'm sure is the way a lot of people in cities felt about 2016.
Absolutely.
Everyone that they know that voted for Clinton or didn't vote at all. And like, I literally don't know a single Trump supporter, like where I live, like not one, like not a single one. And so, you know, this is that idea that Donald Trump is deeply unpopular and people feel that the things that he's doing are potentially going to lead to the downfall of everything that they know and potentially their death. Feels really out there for people that live in areas surrounded by Trump supporters. So now this observable reality leads to a huge question, okay? And this is always the second step. We can see this with UFO conspiracy theories, right? People see something they can't explain that leads to this big question of what is that? And then you start to try and answer the question. But when we try and answer the question, we run into what I would argue is a very simple epistemic problem. And this is an epistemic problem that goes back to the very concept that we can know something that we call truth, right? To do that, to engage in that sort of enterprise where we try and find something that's true in all possible moments, not only do we have to assume a perspective which can encompass all of these possible variables with total information in all possible ways and all possible moments, but we already have to assume that the universe is logical and explainable and unitary, and that therefore there already is something true before we know what it is. Now we run into the problem of, well, once we've made that assumption, we don't know how to find the thing that's true, because if we already knew how to find it, we'd already know what it is. So now we have this kind of cloudy space, right? This sort of space of fog, where there is this profoundly important question that you want to answer for yourself, and absolutely no way to begin to do so, right? And it deepens the sense of being lost. Now, what happens here, and you can see this with people like Alex Jones all the time, they then make the logical leap. So in lieu of information, they start to fill in details between a point A and something they posit as a point B. So in the election conspiracy theory, point A would be every single person that this person knows voted for Donald Trump. And point B is Donald Trump lost. So what happened in the middle there? Now, this is where it gets really interesting. And this is where things like misinformation can sort of insert itself into this kind of discussion. This is where a lot of people's like boomer parents on Facebook have like decided that coronavirus was caused by Italian space satellites or something like that. You know, like this is the realm in which people like Alex Jones and before him, Bill Cooper used to really kind of operate in. And it's this space in which you can concoct relatively elaborate narratives to explain things that then start to build on each other and start to fuse together. So you can start to say, I mean, let's just take global financial cabal theories, for example. Observable fact is you don't have any money, right? And you're really desperate, and so is everyone around you. And the conclusion being those people have a lot of money and seem to have a lot of power as a result. So how do we get there? And in lieu of, say, trying to understand what the International Monetary Fund does, or trying to understand what the World Bank does, or trying to understand even what an organization like the Bilderberg Group, which is a real thing, does, people start to make these assumptions. This is where all the rich people go. Rich people have a lot of power. So therefore, they're making these decisions which are directly controlling, not impacting, but controlling my life. There's no sort of discussion about the nuances of this. And so we see this emerge kind of all the time. And we see this with things like Gladio. We see this with, I mean, even something like the JFK assassination. Back in the 1950s and 60s, the period of time that we're really talking about, and with Gladio into the 70s and 80s, we're really talking about a period of time in which many records that existed are lost, in which many things aren't digitized, in which stuff that's not even classified isn't able to really be found because it's shoved in some file box in some government warehouse somewhere. And it creates this sort of lack of information and this big sort of open space for fiction, for stories to fill in. Now those stories can start to connect to each other. And this is really where it gets dangerous. So this is really where like the all-powerful hand of the CIA conspiracy theory really emerges, okay? We see all these things happening in the world. And depending on your politics, you sort of read those in different ways. So, you know, in my case, I'm reading these all as, you know, various acts of the expansion of the U.S. zone of influence, largely for economic gain, sometimes military intervention as a part of the stabilization of financial circumstance, so on, so on. For tankies, they see this as a CIA plot to suppress the truth of Marxist-Leninism or something like that. And so from there, if you don't have information, you can start to really fill these things in. And you can say, oh, well, there's this uprising in Hong Kong. And there's also this thing that's going on in Russia. And there's this uprising in Kazakhstan. And there's this thing happening in Syria. And they all must be connected because the CIA controls everything. When we hit that point, we've left the realm of actual narrative. We've started to jump and depart from a point of assertion and hyperbole. And this is really the kind of operative point of inflection that I want people who, you know, people who pay attention to conspiracy theories to start to identify for themselves. Where is that point of inflection? Where is the point in which we leave something that's observable and start to enter something which is hyperbolic, right? Generally, whenever someone says, there's a secret government program, but I know about it, and it does this, you already know you've entered the realm of hyperbole for a very basic philosophical reason. If it's a secret program, how does some random person know about it? And so when we can start to break things down epistemically like this and start to ask very basic questions, we can start to see where these logical leaps start to get made. And that's the point in which we all need to step back and we need to leave Chomsky books and start to actually gather as much information from as many places as we can, because it's there. If you don't have the time to do that, well, there are plenty of people that do, and those people often write. And so it does mean at times overcoming something which I think people on the quote unquote left suffer from just as much as the right wing does at this point, which is an almost allergic reaction to sources that come from good information. Those sources are often what are referred to as mainstream media sources or academic institutions. Now, the argument, and this is another, this kind of falls into the realm of conspiracy theory, right? The reality is, obviously, every journalist has a perspective. They're humans. They've lived experiences. They understand certain things when they mean words. There's no such thing as neutral journalism as a result. And so everybody is kind of putting forward a perspective. There's also a reality that the vast majority of those perspectives are relatively, you know, what I would consider to be perspectives which fall within the realm of capitalist liberal democracy. Not conservative or liberal, but they all reinforce kind of a capitalist line. This is the world that we live in. This is the world that we are going to continue to reform, and therefore assuming the legitimacy of that world. Okay, that's all easily observable. Where it becomes a conspiracy theory is when people say all the journalists work together and they're not covering X, Y, or Z story, or they're covering X, Y, or Z story in this very specific way because they're trying to achieve X, Y, and Z thing. Now, with some media outlets like the Post-Millennial, which I would barely call media, that is true. The Gateway Pundit, which is just a conspiracy theory rag at this point, that is also very true. But for something like the New York Times, that's not necessarily the case. And so we need to really start to do a couple of things. The first is we have to actually find information from people that have access to information. Now, sometimes that's us, right? And increasingly what's happening is that normal users of the internet are far better at pushing information out there than traditional media or academic institution. And so you can rely on sources on the ground. But generally, resisting the attempt to always have an answer or an explanation is really critical here. Things are confusing. The world is a complicated, confusing place. We're not always going to know what's happening. And that is okay to say. I think we have this obsession in American political discourse of always being able to know the answer. But that isn't necessarily, in most cases, the case. And we always have these very partial understandings. And so really, it's this question of patience and time and trust and being able to trust information. Now, sometimes when you can't trust information from certain sources, the response is to get it from a variety of sources, right? I mean, these are like research skills that I think many of us know, but at times are willing to suspend, especially when it starts to lead to a conclusion that we don't like, right? And that's something we have to be incredibly cautious about.
Yeah, and thank you for that. And I totally agree. I think that we need to be able to say, I don't know, like, I need to think about this or look more into it. There's some, like, crossover there with toxic masculinity, which is culture-wide of just, I need to have an answer. I need to be controlled of the situation.
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
People need order in prison.
12 Rules for What is a podcast about fascism and the far right from the perspective of the left. It's obviously great stuff, but don't take our word for it. Here is a word from our sponsor.
I'm Jordan Peterson. Now that I have been injected with the anti-fascist super soldier serum, I renounce all my rubbish beliefs about hierarchies and the distribution of sex and dedicate my life, my soul, to the 12 Rules for What podcast.
So that's 12 Rules for What? A podcast about the far right. Get it anywhere you get your podcasts.
12 Rules for What?
So, like, a little bit of, like, a sidebar here. When I was going to college, I was a part of Project Censored out of Sonoma State University.
Oh, yeah, no shit.
Yeah, yeah. I was never in the class, but I participated in some of the judging ceremonies. I got some funding for them to travel. I was at the beginning stages of the radio project, which kind of got shelved for a while, but they sent us to the DNC in LA to cover it. And yeah, it was kind of fun. Like, I guess that was my first podcasting or whatever. So, one thing that was interesting and that kind of broke me from Project Censored as a project was that, well, so, like, for listeners that aren't aware, they published a book for, it might still be being published, but at that point it had been published since, I think, 1972. They would get a class in the sociology department of Sonoma State University together, and they would have the students read through a bunch of different stories and just constantly be reading newspapers and magazines, print media, like whatever, legacy media, as they call it. To pick out, like, stories that they're not finding in the mainstream sources, but they're finding in these smaller sources, do some research on them, find out about the authors of them, find out about what moneyed interests are involved in that specific thing that might be critically covered, and then look at connections to mainstream publishing outlets and those moneyed interests. Because, as, like, working off of Chomsky's idea of manufacturing consent, and that there's a concentration of media ownership, and also David Bersamian and other media theorists talking about how, as media is concentrating, as there's less voices out there, and the voices are also being influenced by the investors that own the newspapers or whatever publishing house, magazine. And so if you are getting funding from General Electric, you're going to put pressure on your editorial boards maybe to not report stuff about arms sales or whatever, or Westinghouse, or, like, any of these companies, since they're so intertwined, sort of, like, mapping the corporate networks and saying, if one of our subsidiary newspapers reports on this thing that is a giant arms sale to Turkey or whatever, and Turkey is getting these weapons from Boeing, and Boeing is owned by this company, which also owns our newspaper, like, maybe have the editors suppress that story or have it written in a way that's not going to piss off their funding source. Like, I think that was an approach towards the idea that journalists may have bias, or there may be bias in the way that a journal is published, that I think makes some sense. However, as a sidebar to the sidebar, like, also the editor, when I was working with the Project Censored, did his doctoral thesis on Bohemian Grove, which is based in Sonoma County. Then after 9/11 happened, when I was in college and working with the project, they started, like, going truther, like, left truther.
Oh, no.
And I was like, well, maybe, I don't know. And then, like, started reading responses by other people, like, who were a little, well, better grounded in conspiracy thinking, and thinking, like, actually, what you all are doing is a lot of promoting disinformation. You need to stop doing it. That's when I, like, started moving away from Project Censored. I don't know where they're at right now, but that's when the looking at the biases in the publishing patterns, not necessarily, or the editorial patterns, not necessarily in the journalist patterns, jumps the shark or whatever. But I think that there is some sort of worth in looking at what is the nature of the institution that's publishing a thing, and, like, what sort of biases. As you said, like, when I read something in the New York Times, I'm not expecting to hear, and I am sometimes surprised, but I'm not expecting to hear an article about an anti-capitalist alternative to, like, the poverty or a banking crisis that's occurred in this one place that people are promoting. But it happens, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to think about this more, rather than on a Chomskyan level, we have to think about it more on a Foucauldian level, right? Meaning that, so Manufacturing Consent is one of those books, and I feel this way about a lot of Chomsky's work, that gets so close to heading in the right direction and then kind of like veers into this world that's very informed by like late 60s, early 70s radicalism. In reality, what we're looking at is we're looking at a structuring of what counts as knowledge, right? Rather than the nuanced management of the individual things that are said, right? So again, let's think about this. And I want to bring forward, there's a mathematical formula. I forget exactly what it is, but someone in the 70s concocted this, I think. But essentially what they said is that every single time you multiply the number of people involved in a conspiracy, you exponentially increase the chance that it gets revealed. So the example I always use when talking about this is this example that a lot of FBI, former FBI people that have been interviewed for like 9/11 documentaries have talked about. But apparently, I think it was like 2002, the US government got their hands on the satellite phone number for Osama bin Laden, meaning they could track his movements, right? Which for the US military is probably a relatively important thing in 2002. And that information was held by an incredibly small group of people, under 100 people knew that information, might be the single most important piece of intelligence data they had at the time. It took less than a day for the media to find out and report on it. Less than a day for potentially the single most important intelligence secret that the US had at that point. Okay. If we were talking really about a world, which I think a lot of people on the left imagine, where there's kind of, you know, some evil guy in a suit stroking a cat on a black leather chair, calling up journalists going, you should report this this way. Go report this this way. Don't report this. It's not just people on the left. People on the right wing feel this way about the media too. Not only is that spectacularly work intensive, right, to the point of being impractical, especially with online media, but it also is one of these structures which, with almost absolute certainty, people would be talking about on some level or another, especially now on the internet. Just mathematically, that would be true. And so really what we're looking at is something a bit more insidious in this case. It's not even that individual messages are being controlled or stories are being censored or something like that. It is more about the social construction of what counts as important and what counts as valid. Oftentimes, and this has changed in the last, say, 3-4 years, I would say, and around where I'm at, it's been a little bit longer than that. But in the past, journalists used to say things like, well, if you don't give me your name, then I can't consider this a legitimate source. Well, why? And I've asked journalists why. And they're like, well, if you're not willing to put your name to it, then I'm just going to assume that you're lying to me, which is a really silly, silly understanding. But it is really tied to this notion of individuality in a capitalist kind of liberal democratic sense and the exchange of information. And that normativity got carried over into that journalistic norm. We see this with any number of things as far as what's considered to be, quote, realistic, right? How many times have journalists said a profound change in society is probably really important, but it's not realistic, so let's focus on reform. That's not because some editor is sitting there going, well, we're going to focus on reformism. It's that the editor hired reformists because reformists are considered legitimate. These kinds of things, we can read through these. That what's happening here is we're getting a portrayal of information in a specific way. And we are able to reinterpret information. We do it all the time. In fact, I would say everyone does it constantly. But as radicals, very obviously, we have chosen to do this as something that we do. We have chosen to reinterpret the things we were taught as children. We have chosen to look at the world really critically. And with that comes a healthy dose of skepticism. And there should always be a healthy dose of skepticism. But there's a difference between that and what I would argue is kind of the Chomskyan claim. And this Chomskyan claim kind of carries through into other forms of kind of inherent mistrust in which, say, for example, on January 6th, this happened consistently. Now, I'm sitting there watching what's going on January 6th, and I'm saying, okay, well, very obviously, they underestimated how serious people were, because it's not like they didn't see the threats online. They were all over the place. Anyone that was paying attention to literally any anti-fascist Twitter account at any point leading up to January 6th was seeing screenshots from Parler of people saying things like they were going to storm the Capitol. I mean, I'd been talking to people about it for weeks before that. Like, it was really obvious it was happening. There was very clearly a sense in which that risk, that threat was underestimated. That definitely impacted coverage patterns in the Capitol complex that day. But then when it became really, 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 really clear that the police were about to get overwhelmed, they fell back and retreated back into what, you know, as someone who's studied DC police tactics a lot, is a really normal pattern, which was fall back and cover points of interest, evacuate important people, and then mass force and move decisively, right? Which is what they did. And they did that at about 5:45 p.m., so 15 minutes before the curfew went into place. Now, all of that is explainable, right? You can sit there and you can say, okay, we can see data that explains this thing, see data that explains this thing, and you can follow the data points all the way through that explanation. Now, what is the narrative that we got, though, from a lot of people? The police intentionally let people into the Capitol because someone saw a couple of pictures of some cops shaking people's hands. So, of course, every single cop just gave up and let all these people into the Capitol. That this was part of a conspiracy by the DC police. That, what was the other one I've heard? That it was intentional that it happened that way. And that the justification for that is that, well, they dealt with protests really differently in the summertime. Okay. So we can look at all the data that we have from January 6th. And we can see individually when decisions were made, how they were made, what the factors were. All of that's been documented. All of that's been released. People have talked about that. All of the different explanations corroborate each other. There's one single outlier, which is the Pentagon report from that day. All the other sources corroborate each other. Okay. None of those sources talk about how the DC police intentionally tried to help a coup attempt. All of those sources talk about exactly the narrative that I'm talking about from that day. We can see similar things from, say, the J20 protests, right? During the J20 protests, during Trump's inauguration, I kept hearing from my parents' friends who were reading on Facebook that every single person that got arrested during Trump's inauguration was a secret white supremacist or an FBI agent trying to make the hashtag resistance look bad.
Fact.
Fact. Absolute fact, right? Alex Jones was running around the G20 in Pittsburgh yelling about how we were all feds as we were getting tear gassed by the National Guard, right? Like basically observable things. And so we can follow narratives point by point from different data points and concoct an understanding, right? Where we start to fall off the realm of believability is often when we start to try and impart motives to other people. And this is a really common sort of failure in human discourse, where we sit there and we go, okay, this happened, therefore, the secret motivation of this person that I don't know is this other thing. That is almost always where we run into trouble. That is where we leave observability. So we can see these things kind of play out in things like Gladio. We can see these things, I mean, on the right wing now, January 6th is an FBI op, or it was done by us. Or something. For some reason, we all dressed up like Trump supporters or something. Not really quite sure how that theory tracks. But all of this, all of these conspiracy theories start to add up to one thing. And this is really the important part. They all wrap back around to the conclusion that was started with, right? And this is the ultimate point to really guard yourselves from, to guard for everyone to kind of be aware of. As the narrative progresses, we'll see the logical leap occur. And if you're really attentive, you'll start to see where that happens. So you take UFO conspiracy theories, and the difference between, say, early UFO conspiracy theorists and Bill Cooper. So for people that don't know, Bill Cooper wrote a book called Behold a Pale Horse. It's probably the penultimate contemporary conspiracy book. It's kind of the reason we have Alex Jones. Bill Cooper is kind of the precursor to that. And he was the first person to start to say, it wasn't just about the government hiding the fact that UFOs exist, right? It's not just that they took the UFO from Roswell and they're hiding it at Area 51. It's that in reality, there's a secret global cabal that is working with the aliens and they're taking this technology. And in exchange for that, they're giving them human children to experiment. And he concocts this whole narrative about it. Now, of course, as time goes on, quote, leakers start to show up, which corroborate parts of that retroactively. When they don't corroborate parts of it, he changes his narrative. And so one of the things that's really unique about conspiracy theories, as opposed to other types of narratives, is the way that they will shift and change sometimes in contradictory ways to maintain their narrative arc. Now, you know, I was trained in philosophy formally. And one of the things that you learn in that process is that if you have to engage in mental gymnastics to maintain your conclusion, it's probably because your conclusion's wrong, right? If you have to start to concoct alternate explanations, if you have to start to leave the realm of observability or believability, if you have to start to posit things as articles of faith, you've already drifted away from anything that could be considered to be properly an argument for a conclusion. You've started to drift into fantasy.
It makes sense at this point to just throw in the term syncretism.
Yes.
Just see what kind of reaction that gets. And that's like what, like the use of the idea of holding multiple contradictory ideas within your head at one time, within your belief structure, and be able to still move forward and make a story that unites these things is considered one of the prime elements of fascism, according to certain definitions, which is not to say that like everything that's bad is fascism or that fascism is everything that's bad or whatever, but like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so I think the thing that becomes really important about conspiracy theories, though, is why, right? I touched on this a bit, but the why is actually really critical for us as radicals to start to understand, right? Because the why indicates something really critical for us. So conspiracy theories arise from situations of uncertainty, necessarily, right? We saw huge, huge, huge explosions of conspiracy theories around, say, the advent of the printing press, for example. A lot of the kind of wars between Protestants and Catholics that happened during that period of time were being driven by conspiracy theories, were being driven by this idea that X, Y, or Z faction was going to come steal your children and forcibly convert them and blah, 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 blah. I mean, the stories that were told that carried down in written text in that period of time sound eerily very similar. So they start with these vast changes and these kind of uncertainties. And then they piggyback off of a sense of threat, right? Or a sense of disempowerment, that it's not that we have conspiracy theories right now because everyone in America feels super politically empowered and stuff like that. No, it's that conspiracy theories rise in situations in which people can no longer explain why they feel like their lives are out of control. We can take a really common example of a really absurd contradiction that arises in this situation. If we talk about white nationalists, right, or white supremacists in general, white supremacy is based on this notion that there is a singular thing called the white race, which is for some reason, superior to everybody. Yet at the same time, they're horribly oppressed by everybody else, even though they are the strongest, most powerful people. It makes no sense. It is an entirely illogical narrative, right? Yet it carries forward. So we have this notion of confusion. We have this notion of dispossession, which exists. I'm not saying the dispossession is always justified, that feeling of dispossession, but that is part of this. It's a feeling of dispossession and this kind of lack of information. And when we combine those three things together, we get conditions that are absolutely perfect, for lack of a better term, for charlatanism, for people who can fill the gaps in. Now, I know a lot of anarchists, like most of us, don't do religion for a lot of reasons, right? And for a lot of us, it has to do with the authoritarianism of the entire concept of religion and the sort of notion of this interface with the divine and how that distorts concepts of knowledge. But what is happening here except that as well? So if we take tankies, for example, it no longer is a question of what information they are getting and repeating. It is purely a question of the source of the information at that point. So if the source of the information is Sputnik, then it's good. If the source of the information is some anarchist blog that disagrees with them, then it's bad. For Trump supporters, if the source is CNN, then it's bad. If the source is Fox, then it might be okay. If the source is OAN, then you know it's right. What that does, though, is at the tail end of conspiracy narrative, we go from confusion to threat. Threat really constructs this notion that there is an easy to identify singular adversary that's trying to destroy you as part of this bigger group. And that then leads to this kind of attachment, right? Now, sometimes that attachment is to a concept of the nation. Sometimes that attachment is to a concept of race. Sometimes it's to a group of people, like in cults, for example, or the religious right in the United States, for example, is held together entirely by the idea that every single person that is not an evangelical Christian is some horrible heathen Satanist who's trying to destroy the world. That it's not just that those people disagree with you, it's that they are conspiring to destroy you. And this is where conspiracy theories stop being just epistemically damaging and start becoming genocidal, is when we start to enter this phase in which the threat and the solidarity of that threat.
We pledge resistance.
What's up? This is Saul Williams chilling here in Montreal, here on CKUT. Peace.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
Give praises to the big man above. He's the only man I love. Salute his majesty now. I say, oh, Jah Rastafari, you wipe the teardrops from my eyes. My eyes, my eyes, my eyes. I know the heathen, them may try. You never let my well run dry. No, all praises to the Most High. You wipe the teardrops from my eyes. My eyes, my eyes, my eyes. I know the prey to see me die. You always lift my feet and I. So I, so I, so I. It's a long time I trod in this journey. And the more I live, I learn. And a little bit of fireman burn. To clear the ways from twist and turn. Give thanks that Jah was beside me. Everything I want him provide me. So no matter where the pagan a chat, Rastafari carry me through every roadblock. I say, oh Jah Rastafari, you wipe the teardrops from my eyes. My eyes, my eyes, my eyes. I know the heathen, them may try. You never let my well run dry. No, all praises to the Most High. You wipe the teardrops from my eyes.